Show on American Freedom Radio Network and the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. You can check up on the archives of shows that you have not seen on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com if you can. In the news today, in fact, I was talking with our Tunisian listener Ahmed today, and he was at school, and a whole bunch of This is alleged, of course. I can't confirm the story, but I have no reason to doubt Ahmed. what's his name? Ben Ali militia apparently waltzed into the school, set it on fire, and then when the students tried to put out the fire with water, they started pelting them with stones, and one of these flew right past his eye. Right in the middle of exam preparations, of course. And apparently, and this is the word on the street, as it is, it's the high school of Jamel that he was at. Everybody's okay. Nobody got hurt. And supposedly, this is the word on the street, Ben Ali has told them that the country must burn, okay, and that the militia should terrify people and even kill them. The wife of Ben Ali promises to burn Tunisia, all of it, and spread terror and death to its population. He doesn't know if that's true, but everybody seems to be saying that. Pretty freaky stuff. And in other news, considering revolts in the Middle East, what was it? Oh, yes. In Egypt, there was a call from the vice president, I believe, for people to stop protesting. And then more protesters turned up than ever before. How do they expect to stop these people? You know, what do you reckon, Will? I mean, are they just that arrogant to think that the people still follow their orders when they clearly don't, or are they just moronic?
Well, they're counting on it, aren't they, I suppose, as most good governments can count on. Majority of people, I just want to live my life and keep out of trouble, and trouble won't come to me.
Keep your head down, preferably buried in the Tunisian sand, and they won't come for you. Yep, that's the philosophy of government.
That's a philosophy of population, sadly. That's a philosophy of most sane, responsible people who are just like, William, keep out of trouble, will you? Such a troublemaker. Oh, yeah, because I invented aspartame and fluoride, and I invented tyranny too.
That's true.
Anyone who resists it has to be the cause of it, right?
Yeah, totally, bro. Will is an evil genius, and he created the entire New World Order system. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com.
Vatican Assassin.
At the Vatican, that's right, on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Thank you very much for our international listeners for tuning in, and we'll be right back after the break. And the nights are quite cold. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest for you joining us on the line from the US of A today. Her name is Glenn Dean Grant, and she's come on to talk with us about, well, human trafficking. Now, one of you, if there's anybody out there who's involved in human trafficking, we'd certainly love your comments. Email producer at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com with your name and address and local law enforcement so we can call the cops on you and get you arrested and thrown in jail for the rest of your natural life. Glenn Dean Grant, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show.
Thank you, Vinny. And I agree. Anyone wants to call in, we'll just trace the call and we'll track them down for sure.
Oh, now, well, it's good that you've still got a sense of humour after all the terrible things you've gone through, Glenn Dean. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the point of my show as well.
Exactly. forgot that you did deal with humour, which is makes it actually a good show for me. I lost my humour for a long time, but I've regained it, and I'm thankful for that.
Oh, nice. It's kind of, but it's not like keys, you know, you just drop them and then you've got to go back and search for them. It's kind of like more of a self-discovery to get your humor back, wouldn't you agree?
You're right. The reason is, the way I kind of looked at it is I had a couple choices. I could do nothing, I could be sad, and I could sit here and be depressed and cry, or I could step up and I could make sure that... you know, I mean, nobody really understands yet the point of my case. I do have a daughter who is the victim of human trafficking, and it was because of that I've become involved. I have no schooling. I have no formal training whatsoever. At the very most, I worked for a private investigator years ago. Other than that, I'm a mom and a grandma, and I'm also the mother of a child who's been missing almost 5 years now. And that's what made me, sort of step up to the plate and try to do what I can. I try to educate and I try to just bring awareness. And, of course, I try my hardest to find my child. She's an adult. She went missing at 21. And, you know, Vinny, she's going to be 27 in May.
Can I venture a guess here? She was a really pretty girl as well, wasn't she?
Absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. Blonde hair, hazel eyes. You know, she had, you know, braces when she was young, so of course she's got the perfect teeth, the perfect skin, you know, very, very good at hair and makeup, dressed really well. You know, she was a tomboy growing up. I have friends who thought I had three little girls and a boy named Jesse. But Jesse's a girl. And Jesse was a tomboy when she was little, but she turned into the girliest girl when she hit high school. And you know, very popular, very fun. You know, her story, it's tragic, you know. I mean, you did introduce me as from the USA, and we are close. I'm actually from Canada. I'm in Canada, but Jesse went missing in the USA. So Jesse is an international endangered missing person, and she's also the victim of human trafficking. And, you know, since March 29th of 2006, when we first, that was the first day we realized Jesse was missing. And the truth is, the last day we talked to her was the day before. With Jesse, we knew instantly something was wrong. I'm going to backtrack a bit, Vinny, because I know there's going to be a lot of people who have heard of Jesse's story. But
I was going to say, let's start at the beginning.
Exactly. That started initially, when Jesse was still in high school. I'll just say briefly, in high school, she met a fellow when she was dating this one guy. And luckily for us, you know, he remembered this person. But she met him in high school, and when she was probably still 16 or 17 years old. And then when she was 20 years old, years later, she'd moved out of Alberta back to British Columbia. She was invited on a trip. And to me, when I talk about it, it sounds like a movie, even coming from myself. Because that is how movies work. A girl would be taken on a trip. They would lavish her with gifts and all these wonderful things. And then at the end, they would say, but you owe us now. And that's what we believe happened to Jessie. She was first taken to Florida. She was in Fort Lauderdale. She was in the Keys. I was concerned. I thought, you know, who's going to take you on an all-expense-paid trip and not expect anything? And that was the gist of this trip. A friend wanted her to accompany him, just be company for him. He didn't want to go alone. Me, I'm older. I'm like, what does he want? Right off the bat, no one does this for free. No one does this for nothing. And so she said, Mom, I'm okay. I've known him for a long time. So she went, and she came back within just a few days. She had the most wonderful pictures of her on the Atlantic Ocean, parasailing and jumping on trampolines and in the boats. And it just looked like, you know, a fabulous time. And so I thought, okay, I overreacted. And then a couple weeks later, she's invited to go on another trip. So, and I'm saying, okay, Jesse, there is something going on here. Doesn't matter what you tell me. I'm old and I know things, you know. She says, Mom, I'm okay. The last trip was fine. And so she went on this other trip. Well, this trip was to Manhattan, New York, and to Atlantic City, New Jersey. And it was also for just a few days. And the day before they were to leave, I get a frantic call from Jesse. She was, she was down in the lobby of the hotel they were staying at in Manhattan, and she was very upset, and she told me that her friend Don had just suggested that she prostitute herself. He had spent all of his money at the casino. The casino's in Atlantic City, and said, we need some money. We need, you know, to have some, you know, money to get home. We need to have, you know, be able to eat. The flight was paid for. And so Jesse got very upset, and she left and went downstairs, and she called me, and I was beside myself. I just knew all of the thoughts that I had. I wasn't just, you know, like some corrupt-minded old lady. I was right. I knew this man wanted something. And I said to Jesse, you need to, okay, what are we going to do? We need to get you away from there. And she says, well, no, Mom, I'm okay. He's not mean. I'm not afraid of him. I just can't believe he would do this. And she just called him an ass. He's just an ass. And I said, well, I'm really worried for two reasons now. I'm worried about him, and I'm also worried that you're alone in a motel, in a hotel in New York City alone. And she says, I'll be okay. I'm going to go back up to my room. I just wanted to tell you what happened, because I'm, you know, she was shocked. And I said, well, I don't know. I just wish that I had the funds. I would have just hopped on a flight, gone there, and brought her home myself. But she says, I'll be okay. I'm going to go up, and I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to get on the plane in the morning and come home. And so the next morning, I get a call from Jesse, and their plans had changed. And she was no longer coming home that day. Now she was all excited because they're going to take her, he is going to take her to Las Vegas. And I said, no. This is getting carried away. She said, I'm going to go. I'll call you when I get to Las Vegas. Now, this was exactly May 13th. The day that she touched down in Las Vegas. It was 2 weeks exactly till her 21st birthday. And 21 is the age of legal limit down in Nevada. We're from British Columbia, where the age limit for going to bars and buying lottery tickets and everything is 19. So she'd already been out and about, and she, you know, it's not like she'd never been to a bar, but she'd never been to Las Vegas. So she tells me she's going to stay until her 21st birthday and celebrate it like a lot of young Canadians do. I'm beside myself at this point, and I'm like, I said, no, you're not staying in Las Vegas. I'm already worried enough about what's happening. And I said, I don't know anybody down there. And, you know, Vinny, one thing that, and I wasn't, you know, being prophetic. I wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a thought that I had. It was just my dramatic motherness. And I said to my daughter, Jesse, I don't know anybody down there. If you ever went missing, where would I start looking for you? I don't have a number. I have nothing. Those words haunt me, Vinny. 10 months later, Jesse went missing. But I did not think she would. It's not like I had a feeling, you know, or I would have, you know, gone and got her. But I just, you know, be dramatic. What am I going to do? How would I, if you lost your cell phone, how would I get a hold of you? And so she gave me a number of another young woman. Her name is, her nickname was the Angel, is what she told me. And she talked like they were, you know, friends and everything. I'd never heard of her, you know. And so I'm trying to stay calm, and I'm saying, okay, Jess, you're almost 21 years old. You're an adult. I'll give you tell your birthday, you know. But and she kept in touch with us every day. Every day, if she didn't phone me or one of her three sisters or one of her two stepsisters or her dad or her stepmom, or one of her hundreds of friends, you know, she would text us. So it was either phone calls or emails or text messages, or a lot of times back then, a lot of people used MSN. It was before Facebook. You know, it was Facebook was just starting up, actually. So 2 weeks went by. Her birthday came, and her birthday went. And then I said, okay, you're coming home. And she said, Mom, I can't. Angela and I were in a car accident. And I suppose you're kind of seeing this, the way they do this, right? They keep giving them more excuses. Right? So now she's like, Mama, I was in the car with Angel. We were going through a green light right behind the city bus. And a cab blew a red light and, you know, sideswiped us. And so now we have an insurance claim we have to wait for. I said, you don't have to wait down there, Jesse. Get home. She said, no, I do. There's going to be, you know, court. We're going to have to, you know, give it statements. And we're going to have to do all these things. And so now I'm waiting for this. And then, you know, and now it's only the end of May. So now we're getting into June.
This whole incident, how many times have you told her to come home during this period of time?
I told her over and over. She... You know, I'll tell you one thing. I know that I did not suspect a thing. I know that she came up with a lot of excuses, but unfortunately, though I was leery, I never had any trouble with Jessica. She was on the honor roll when she was in high school. She was in sports. She was never into drugs. She didn't even smoke cigarettes. You know, like, I'm not, you know, sure she liked to go out and go to nightclubs and dance and have cocktails and like all young people do, but, you know, she never had any issues with any problems like that. She's never been in trouble with the law, definitely, in her whole life. She was never even, you know, I never even got a call from her school growing up. She was just a good kid. So when she told me everything was okay, though my gut said it's not, you know, my head believed her. You know, my head thought, Jessie's not going to start lying to me at 21 years old. At the point that she's an adult, why would she even feel she needs to? So I bought it. I bought into what she was, and I'll say it this way, Vinny. I bought into what she was told to tell us. You know, 21 years old, if not lying to her mom, you know, there's a reason. And I do believe the reason was, you know, she was either brainwashed or threatened or blackmailed or whatever the wordings you want to use. Some people say she went to Las Vegas. I say she was lured there. Others say she was taken. It's all just wording. The fact of the matter is, Jessie was taken to Las Vegas, and she was kept there. And she was kept there for 10 months. And when she was planning on coming home, she vanished, literally off the face of the earth. Talked to her one day, gone the next. And, you know, so when in June, suddenly she's met this guy. Oh, I met a great guy, Mom. He's, what's he? He's a twin. He's got an identical twin. Their parents are from New Jersey. They own a whole string of McDonald's restaurants. And these two twins get $5,000 a month from a trust fund, and they don't have to work, though the brother, he worked for the school board in Nevada. But you know, her so-called boyfriend did not work. She said he liked to fix up race cars, and he liked to race. You know, he'd do some car racing. Nevada has a nice racetrack there. So, you know, nothing was completely, you know, out of the ordinary. I still didn't like it. She told me he was a bit older. She told me he was 34 years old. But it turned out he was almost 40. Turned out he was no more her boyfriend than, say, you are my boyfriend, Vinny, because he used her and he beat her. I'll explain the term. It's called love bombing, and it's one of the things I've learned over the years of learning of human trafficking. And it's what human traffickers and pimps do to girls. If the girl is a drug addict, they just ply them with drugs, and then the girls will comply. And if they, you know, wanted money, maybe they were raised, you know, poor, and they never had nice things, they buy them nice things. Jessie neither was a drug addict, nor was she destitute. But Jessie was, you know, like she was 20 years old. She wanted to fall in love.
And young and did. Easy to manipulate, and isn't that one of the real curses of youth? But also one of the most exciting things about it is that, you know, you get yourself into all these interesting situations, and you learn a whole lot.
You do.
In my youth, I learned a whole lot of terrible things.
Yes, and you know, and that you still learn from the terrible things. First of all, you learn that that's not what you want to do, so you don't do bad. You do good. You learn. I don't think Jesse was given a lot of choices after she was taken to Las Vegas. I think she was given a lot of choices prior. But once she was down there, I think her choices stopped. After Jesse went missing, we hired a private investigator who found out almost immediately Jesse had been beaten and hospitalized. She'd been forced to work for an escort agency, and she'd been arrested for solicitation of prostitution. She'd been arrested two times. Once there was one charge, and the second time there was four charges. Now, we're talking about a girl who'd never broken the law in 21 years, and suddenly she's, you know, in Las Vegas. And one of the reasons that the police never took her case seriously is because, in their opinion, she was just some low-life Canadian chick who wanted to go down to Las Vegas and become a prostitute and make some fast money. They never looked at anything else. They never looked at the fact that Jesse kept in touch with us for 10 months. They never, you know, looked at any of the things. Like, we found stuff in Jesse's storage locker. I'll explain one other thing. Jesse did come home once in the 10 months she was there. She was taken there in May. She came home at the end of November. We almost thought she was not going back. The fighting and the screaming and the arguing that went on between her and this so-called, at this point now he was her fiancé, was just, it was unbelievable. I've never seen or heard somebody fighting so much with somebody else and still care about that person. And when she was in Calgary visiting her father, it was the same thing. It could have been 3 o'clock in the morning, and she'd be yelling on the phone, and they'd be arguing when she was here and on the cell phone. And so we, you know, and then it was getting closer to Christmas. She'd been in Canada almost a month.
Sounds like marriage material to me.
Well, you know, and that's what's bothered me the most. When she did go back, I thought, you know what, she didn't choose to go back. And it was, but you know what, it's all hindsight, which of course we all know is perfect vision. Because when we got up on Christmas morning and we opened our gifts and we were planning on going to my elderly father, my dad's been a widow since 1998. We go to his house for Christmas dinners every year. He just lives up the block from me. I'm a block and a half from where I grew up. And I'm still in the same house my kids grew up in. They haven't moved since 1987. So, you know, we're a very stable family. So when we had plans and she said, oh, you're going to have to take me to the airport, I looked at her in the face and I said, oh, no, we're not taking you to the airport today. It was Christmas Day. She insisted. She told us if we didn't, she'd just phone a cab. And I was crying. I was so upset. I'm like, how could you leave on Christmas Day? She was so insistent. We drove her to the airport. The last time I laid my eyes on my daughter was Christmas Day.
Last time you saw her on Christmas Eve, what a wonderful present. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. Our very special guest is Glendine Grant, joining us live from Canada, in fact. And we'll be right back after the break with more.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The lighter side of genocide. It's a fabulous, wonderful, hot, sunny day here in Auckland, New Zealand. But elsewhere in the world, things are a little bit colder and a little bit darker. Like where our special guest, Glendine Grant, is right now. Glendine, welcome back.
Thank you, Vinnie.
All right. Now, Will, you had a question for her.
Yeah. Glendine, I mean, I was wondering, what do we know about this 40-year-old individual who has taken off with your daughter here?
Well, we know he didn't take off with her. We believe he either gave her away, sold her, or murdered her. He's still in Las Vegas. He is known to the police as a pimp. That was one of the very first things we found out. He has an estranged wife that we thought he was divorcing, but it turned out that was just one of their little games they play. She's actually into porn, and she's a prostitute, and she's also worked at the Money Ranch, which is one of the few legal spots for prostitution in Nevada. And we also have heard from other people that he's very violent, that he's actually got a spousal abuse charge against him from his wife, And we know that he has got some very... we do know that his parents know nothing about him. I actually contacted his parents. I had Jesse's phone bills, so I was able to get all the numbers. And one of them was to a New Jersey, and I phoned it, and it turned out to be his father. I asked his father, how did he know about Peter's fiance who was missing? And he said, no. As far as he knew, his son was married to someone else, not engaged to anyone. So that just, further told me that, it wasn't a real engagement in his mind. And so, what we did find out is that this guy was a liar, that he was violent, and that he was a pimp.
How did he get away with doing that? Because prostitution being, it's legal here in New Zealand, but not in the United States. How can somebody be known to the police as a pimp and still be getting away with it? I mean, the one thing about human trafficking, I mean, this is an assumption on my part, but I always suspect police involvement because otherwise it wouldn't really be able to happen quite so often as it does.
And that's exactly, that's how I was going to answer it. That's a very good question. How did he get away with it? How is it that the police on the case have done nothing, yet every single other person who's heard about Jesse, not only are they astounded by what we know, but they're also blown away that the police have really done nothing. I've had other police who tell me they can't believe that North Las Vegas has done nothing. I've had human trafficking experts in the United States and Canada tell me her case is a classic case. The places she was taken to, Florida, New York, Atlantic City, and Las Vegas, are four of the biggest hubs in the United States for human trafficking. Jesse was taken to every one of them. I've had Jesse's story told on so much media. Her story's been told on America's Most Wanted twice, actually, and Montel Williams twice, but also documentaries. There's been several books. One of the more recent books just came out in October of last year, and it was written by Professor Benjamin Perrin. He's a law professor in UBC, which is the University of British Columbia, and he is one of Canada's, if not Canada's, leading expert in human trafficking. And from the very first time he heard of Jesse's case in 2007, he told me right off the bat that he believed that her case was a classic case. That's when I heard the word classic for the first time. How can there be a classic case of human trafficking in North America in this day and age? And yet, since then we found out so much. Not only is her case a classic case, but at the time Jesse went missing, human trafficking was really still unknown as a problem in North America. I was told by many people when she first went missing, because I suspected this right off the bat, and I don't even know how. I mean, what I would say is Jesse was forced to work in prostitution. When she tried to leave, she was taken away. And one day someone said, that's human trafficking. And that's when it realized that for months I'd been discussing human trafficking without even realizing that was the term. All I knew is it was done against her will. And there wasn't even a criminal code in the United States for human trafficking. It was considered transporting a minor across state line, kidnapping, all these things against a person's will, where now there's a criminal code, and it's human trafficking is the charge. And there's been a lot of cases that have been tried, and they've been convicted. Here in Canada, too. We actually got a criminal code even before the United States. We've just recently passed a law. I helped one of our MPs. She had her bill. She wanted mandatory minimum sentencing for those convicted of human trafficking in minors. And just this June, the law was passed, and now there's a 5-year minimum mandatory. Now, if you talk to MP Joy Smith, she would tell you she wanted to go for a 100-year mandatory minimum. But, of course, that would never pass. She had to go with something that would have passed, and 5 years did. So now, instead of maybe getting 90 days,
they're getting 5 years.
Well, the
thing is, human trafficking is quite a widespread problem, and indeed, there's usually involvement at higher levels.
There is.
Will, you've put a post on the Vinnie Eastwood Show Facebook page that where DynCorp has been exposed for the trafficking of women and children.
Oh, yeah, DynCorp was involved in, because they had contracts in the Middle East where the UN was working in peacekeeping roles. I mean, one of their subsidiaries, anyway, an individual belonging to one of their, actually a ring of individuals, were accused and actually tried, I believe. I don't know how far the prosecution process ended up going, but Cheney was, in fact, sorry, Rumsfeld was questioned about this by Cynthia McKinney in sort of 2005. So this occurred in around 2003, at the same time George Bush was delivering speeches at the UN on the subject of international kidnapping rings, saying that anyone found responsible should be dealt with to the full extent of the law. At the same time, subsidiaries of engineering giants that he was connected to personally were involved in exactly such kidnapping rings.
So,
Cynthia McKinney seemed to be the only person in Congress at the time who had some heartfelt concerns around the issue. But, of course, it didn't go too far. And that's the thing, it's like a global phenomenon and no one can cure it. And no one can really solve all these crimes. America's Most Wanted is not going to the end of the day because they're not going to indict the police.
You know what we can do, though? We can educate ourselves and our young and all of our good citizens, because there's way more good than there are bad. And though it's not going to stop it, it will, I think, show a significant difference, and it's going to take a while. And I know this because I've been going into schools for the last year and a bit, and I educate students. I tell them about Jesse. I tell them about human trafficking. Since then, Crime Stoppers started doing the same thing. However, it was they were about a year later than I was doing it. And I've actually been told by other people that I started doing my things and Crime Stoppers followed. That's pretty big to hear that. I've been told I'm the only mother in Canada who is currently the mother of a trafficked victim who speaks out. I speak at events. I go to human trafficking launches of new organizations. I go to fundraisers trying to raise money to build homes to house the...
Oh, we unfortunately have lost you, Glenda?
No, I don't know what happened. It just went blank and then it came back, so I apologize. Oh,
There we go. It's all good. It's probably just the NSA tapping your phone.
Exactly. Somebody says, okay, let someone else talk, Wendy.
Continue, please.
Well, I've got a lot to say. 5 years of this. It's hard to cram. That's why I talk fast and I say a lot, because I'm still only going to get a small percentage in of what I have to say, what I know. There's so much that we've learned, over the years, and it's mind-boggling. And, I just wanted to touch a little bit on what Will had just said about how high up people are when they're involved. I don't know if you have heard of this case. It was from 1982, and it was from in the United States. A young boy, his name is Johnny Gosch, G-O-S-C-H. Now, if you want to learn about child human trafficking, child porn, Russian pedophile websites, CIA and higher involvement, you look that case up, and you will never, you'll either stop reading it right away because of how horrific it is, or you won't be able to stop because there's so much. There's videos after videos after videos of people, and we're talking about heads of CIA. We're talking about the most high up people, and they're the ones that want these people. They're the ones that want the boys, and they're the ones that want the young women that are being taken. And how do you stop it when they're the ones that are making the laws, enforcing the laws, and they're the ones with all the money?
Well, it's the same with all these other problems we talk about. And yes, I have come across some of those articles, and they're pretty sickening, to be honest.
They are sickening.
And it's the elite all around the world. I've got articles with Italian elites, Turkish elites, Saudis involved in trafficking of children, over 30,000 children from Dubai, the Blair government involved, Belgium, Chilean, top Chilean officials. Anyone just go to Google News, you can find all this.
Exactly. People say, aren't you afraid? I'll tell you, what? I've been through what every parent's worst fear is. And that's having your child go missing or attending your own child's funeral. I haven't done that. I don't believe my daughter's dead. I don't believe she is. In my heart, in my soul, and with everything I have learned, I believe that she is being trafficked, perhaps around the United States, but perhaps around the world. It's been 5 years. She's getting older now. My concerns are what happens to the women when they do get older. I am scared of that. I am not scared of... I'm not even afraid of confronting a human trafficker, to be honest with you.
Have you seen the 2009 Liam Neeson movie, Taken?
Yeah. Which was That was a good movie, and I'll say, as far as movies are concerned, I was happy with it. I like mystery and suspense movies. But the
it's
one
funny how you
thing
should
that
say that, Will,
because really
that was exactly,
me, you know,
exactly what I was
movie?
Thinking.
The only
yeah,
problem with that
was
really take it. This is exactly what it sounds yeah. like.
They
know?
Use a pretty boy at the airport to catch the girls.
But you know
and,
what?
And
if your father's not an ex-CIA spy, you're going to end up like the friend, and you're going to end up dead. She was rescued. Oh, go figure. Because her dad, which whose dad is an ex-CIA spy that can fly around the world and have contacts everywhere and grab his daughter within 72 hours, it doesn't happen. That's
yeah, yeah, yeah.
what
it's
I did not like about
yeah.
the movie.
Yeah.
If my
yeah.
daughter wasn't a traffic victim, I would have loved the movie. But it just
yeah.
told me, you know what? Are you telling me my kid's dead? Because we didn't, you know, we're not Liam Neeson. And so, yeah.
No, sorry. I didn't mean it in that respect. I mean, the only respect I meant it was it showed that there were at least layers to the onion.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
you know, this guy, what's his name, Peter?
Peter,
I mean,
yeah, Peter Todd.
He's probably just some lower-level dupe pawn in a larger game, and that's why the police didn't take it up, you know.
Yeah. I wish that there was, you know, a way for me to know, you know, exactly, you know, why. And I know if I wanted to, you know, and I do try to be fair, and I'll tell you fairly, I can almost, you know, maybe they just didn't think, like everyone else, they just didn't think this happened in, you know, in this day and age, on this continent. But you know what? It's been 5 years, and everybody else under the sun has stepped up, but the North Las Vegas police are still making me run her investigation. I'm the lead investigator on my own daughter's case. I have to do it from another country. I can't even get a response from the police. They find remains out in the desert in Las Vegas. I get emails from a dozen people all over Las Vegas who are there for me. I can't even get a response from the police. Please let me know when these results come through. I have to get an organization. I am even friends with the coroner in Metro Police, in Metro Las Vegas, because I can't get any answers or any response from the North Las Vegas police who are on the case. And that, to me, is the worst.
And the case is still open. It's still
it's open.
And that's,
it's open.
Yeah.
And it's hot.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Hasn't gone
they can't even give you a response.
Nope.
Yeah,
I went
yeah.
3 years without a reply to an
And the media really doesn't try and take this on seriously. For example, an article that was released on Guerrilla Media not too long ago, it was 5,200 Pentagon employees purchased child pornography. This was on CNN.
Oh, my God. Yeah, see?
You know?
What? Yeah. There's so many things I just don't get. I don't get anybody interested in child porn. Not,
well,
I don't care.
Because,
you need your eyes poked out with hot pokers.
From the perspective of a sane person who isn't psychotic, who thinks that a system should work, therefore it doesn't make sense. However, if you're psychotic, murdering scumbags, it makes perfect sense.
You're right.
I mean, prostitution is the oldest industry, as we all know, and, well, that's debatable, but, I mean,
yeah.
I think it's just always going to be around as long as there's as lust is around, and good people have to stand up and rally together and confront this stuff, otherwise it's going to keep going on.
Have you ever
yep,
heard of
that's
the
That's right,
model?
And we're going to try and do that next segment on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, our very special guest from Canada will give us more details after the break. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show! American Freedom Radio and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Child traffickers, and particularly the elite, they really love opera. Now, our very special guest, Glendon Grant, joins us live from Canada. And one thing I'd really like to hear about this case is, like, have you actually, you haven't been getting any help from the police whatsoever. What about FBI or anybody else? I mean, I would imagine for some reason that they haven't helped you either.
Well, FBI was involved in 2007, human trafficking task force in Las Vegas called ATLAS, the Anti-Trafficking League Against Slavery, opened up, and it consisted of many high-powered groups. FBI was one of them, Metro Police, you know, several police forces in and around Clark County, and at that point was the only time FBI was involved. I tried so hard. When Jesse first went missing, I tried to get FBI involved. And you want to know what they told me? They told me, because Jesse had been arrested for prostitution while she was in Las Vegas, that they felt that it was not a crime that they would, it was not a case they would be able to look into. Again, I tried to let them know that, you know, how can that be fair when Jesse was forced into prostitution? I mean, if Jesse wanted to prostitute herself, would she really have needed to be beaten? You know, I mean, why would they need to beat her if she, you know, wanted to do this? So obviously...
Well, I mean, that's one side of the element. The other side of the element is if somebody commits a crime, you'll never be able to go to the authorities for help with anything. Like if you snatch a candy bar out of a 7-Eleven and then you get murdered, they go, ah, well, he's a criminal, I won't investigate.
Great point. Exactly. You know, I went down to the States several times. I went down there to Las Vegas in 2006 and 2007. I was in New York for the Montel Williams show in 2007. Went to go back to tell Las Vegas that to watch this show. I was going to do a media release. I got blocked at the border, told I couldn't cross. I tried it again several months later, same thing. Now, I was allowed in three times. Now I'm not allowed in because apparently somebody found that in 1986, a roommate of mine was arrested and charged with some drugs in 1987. Now, it's all on record. They were not my drugs. It was not mine. Everything, you know, I've been so open with everything that even when this happened, I pasted and posted everything that happened from that time so people understood I'm not hiding anything. But to me, if I was allowed in three times and suddenly blocked, in my opinion, whoever let me in the first three times should be in trouble because they should not have let me in if I'm that, dangerous. But the truth is, somebody just needed to find a reason to keep me out of there. I was becoming too vocal. I was becoming too involved with human trafficking organizations. I've started my own. It's called MAF, Mothers Against Trafficking Humans. I have not, at this point, it's still on Facebook. It's a lot of talk, but I'm learning a lot by being involved in other organizations. But I've got over 10,000 people on my MAF group and my MAF cause on Facebook. I've got people around the world whose children they know are human trafficking victims, and they want to get involved. I mean, Amy Fitzpatrick, you know, they're from, you know, she was kidnapped in Spain on New Year's Day, 2009, you know what, I honestly can't remember the year, and I apologize for that. But they believe that she's a victim of human trafficking. Her mother wants to get involved. You know, Jesse's story has been told on the news in South Africa by a missing person organization over there that is one of our Jesse supporters. You know, Jesse is the most well-known unknown missing person in the world. And I say most well-known because she's known by millions. I say unknown because she's still not known by your everyday person. I mean, I can talk to people in my own city. I live in a city of 87,000 people, and there are still people who, and there's few of them, but there's still some people who have never heard of Jesse. And I look at them, I go, you must live under a rock, you know, and I'm not being mean at all. Because she's in the news all the time. I'm in the news all the time. I've been teamed up with Crime Stoppers, going into high schools. You know, when I get invited to Toronto, like last 2 weeks ago, I went to Toronto to help launch the Alliance Against Modern Slavery. It was all in the news because Kamloops is so proud of their mom, what their mom's doing for her kid, that they can't keep me out of the news. And yet people still don't know who she is. So I call her the most well-known unknown missing person. And she's also a poster child for human trafficking in Canada. I've been told by survivors of human trafficking she is the most well-known in all of Canada. And I've been told by Professor Perrin she is definitely most well-known in Western Canada as a human trafficking victim. And my goal is one day...
I would say if you had dirt dug up on you from 1986, 1987, that, that this does lead somewhere high to a government position, and they're just profiling you, they've obviously profiled you, mm-hmm. to get any tiny bit of dirt they possibly could to try and shut you down.
That's right.
So I would say that indicts some high-level players of some sort anyway.
Well, you're right.
In which case, you would start looking at any organizations you can find, sort of, there'd probably be low-level street gangs. I don't know what the gangs are up there in Canada. Working in with the police and the government at some level.
I know there's got to be a way. I mean, I obviously haven't figured it out yet, but there's got to be a way, you know. I'll find Jesse, or I will die trying. And when Jesse comes home alive or dead, I will not stop what I'm doing. I won't stop until I am myself dead. I will continue. I will combat human trafficking. I will advocate. I will educate. And I will do anything I can to prevent, you know, any other mom or any other girl, you know, from going through what we're going through.
All right, Glendine, I'd like to thank you so much for coming on the show with us today and sharing your story. Do you have a website you can plug for us there?
Yes, we do. Right now, it's still we've been updating it, so it's under construction, but it's been up there for many years. It's www.jessiefoster.ca. Jessie is spelled J-E-S-S-I-E, and then Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R, and C-A because we're Canadian. So jessiefoster.ca, and if anybody wants to just type Jessie Foster into Google, you just have to type Jessie and the letter F, and she's the second Jessie F on Google. That's huge. I have manipulated the internet. I have got Jessie to come up in Google searches no matter what you look under, and because of that, she's ended up on documentaries on network television, Nancy Grace, Jane Velez Mitchell. The National Enquirer did a full page on my daughter. You know, that's, you know, I mean, I'm not going to stop.
And yet, the authorities still won't get off their keisters. No. Thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. See you later. Ladies and gentlemen, coming up next segment, we have a Kiwi collaborator for you and a little bit more news. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. We'll be right back. Fastest 2 hours in talk radio. Whew. Man, that was intense. Human trafficking is no joke. Even on this show, where we joke about even the worst kind of stuff. Now, we may, operatively, have a guest on the line for you today. Gordon Israel coming at us live from New Zealand. Gordon, are you on the line there? Expect not. All right, so continuing on, I wanted to play a YouTube clip for you all, ladies and gentlemen. My most recent upload to YouTube entitled, Does John Key Profit from New Zealand Foreign Debt? Now, anybody, this is quite an interesting thing, and hopefully this puppy will go viral because, well, yep, John Key's a scumbag, in my opinion, and he kind of needs to be stopped, you know, because it's really, really just bad getting the country into massive amounts of debt. So without further ado, here we go.
So let's talk about the economy for just a minute. This is the position of what has happened over the last sort of, I guess, 10 or so years in New Zealand. So we've built up a lot of debt, and it's primarily not at the government level, it's actually at what's called the private sector. So it's mum and dad right across New Zealand, businesses, farms, pond line yards. We owe lots of money. So much so that we owe 85% of it to foreigners. So we owe 85% of our economy, and the overwhelming bulk of it is to foreigners. So no OECD country, so there are 30 countries in the world that are developed economies, no country in the world borrows a bigger percentage of their money from foreigners than New Zealand.
Donald Penny Bright, I hope to be seeing you in Parliament after the Botany by-election.
I won't wish you luck, because Jamie Lee Ross is our guy, and I think he'll do a fabulous job, but you know, we like democracy, though.
Regarding a grown-up conversation about debt,
yep.
Prime Minister, on the 26th of January, I sent you an Official Information Act request asking, on a line-by-line accounting basis, could you please provide the detailed information which shows exactly to whom New Zealand has become indebted since National Act government came to power in November 2008. And I asked in particular the information which confirms whether or not New Zealand has become indebted to the Bank of America, any subsidiaries of the Bank of America, or any lending institutions of any form which have connections to the Bank of America. I have yet to have an acknowledgement to this request. The reason why I'm asking, Prime Minister, is because according to the Register of Pecuniary Interest, you...
Yeah.
I won't wish you luck, because Jamie Lee Ross is our guy, and I think he'll do a fabulous job, but you know, we like democracy, though.
Regarding a grown-up conversation about debt,
yep.
Prime Minister, on the 26th of January, I sent you an Official Information Act request asking, on a line-by-line accounting basis, could you please provide the detailed information which shows exactly to whom New Zealand has become indebted since National Act government came to power in November 2008. And I asked in particular the information which confirms whether or not New Zealand has become indebted to the Bank of America, any subsidiaries of the Bank of America, or any lending institutions of any form which have connections to the Bank of America. I have yet to have an acknowledgement to this request. The reason why I'm asking, Prime Minister, is because according to the Register of Pecuniary Interest, you are a shareholder in the Bank of America, and are you personally profiting from New Zealand's growing indebtedness? And when will I get an answer to my question?
Sadly, no, I'm not. We can ask your due diligence that comes from those people who got that together. I wouldn't have a clue whether they borrowed any money off them. They would. They do it at commercial rates. And the reason I'm a shareholder of the Bank of America is because I was a very long-term shareholder of Merrill Lynch. When I was at a company that was very well run, but unfortunately when I left, it wasn't, and Bank of America bought them when they went broke.
And you can watch that video at youtube.com/MrNewsGorillaMedia because you've really, really got to watch it to see his tell signs, his physical reactions and all of that kind of stuff. It is classic. Love to see the Prime Sinister squirm. Speaking of making the sinister squirm, I believe we have on the line a very special guest coming live from New Zealand, as I said, Gordon Israel. Gordon, are you there, mate?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I'd love it if you'd actually divulge just a little bit about yourself, you know, who you are and how you really got into activism.
Oh, well, the short version is I was born and raised in America, and I was my father's a Yankee, my mother's a Southern Belle, and I've been torn between the war between the states ever since. So I grew up knowing there was something wrong with the world, wasn't sure what it was. And about the day I got my first paycheck at age 17, I decided that it was the income tax that was wrong with the world. And so I spent a number of years plotting and scheming how I could get out of income tax. And I had actually lived for a few years of my childhood in the Caribbean. So I read somewhere that if you had an offshore company, that, you know, you could get all of your income offshore, and you didn't owe any tax in America on that. And that resonated with me, because I could immediately see it. Unlike a fair number of Americans, I actually knew what it was to live outside of the country. And so with that as a starting point, I tried to figure out how I could structure my life to get out of income tax by you know, being outside the country financially, but still living inside the country. And it only took me a few years to figure out that you actually had to be pretty darn wealthy for that to be a worthwhile course of action. So I gave up on that, and about the time I gave up on that, some businessmen made headlines. This was, I think, 1999, because they took out full-page advertisements in the USA Today newspaper, which goes across the country, of course, saying that we do not withhold income tax from our employees' paychecks because there's no law that requires us to. And I... That got my attention, because in the world that I was raised in, these guys were convicted criminals. You know, there was no need to hold a trial. You know, it was just a matter of locking them up and then figuring out how long they're supposed to stay behind bars. I mean, with an admission of like that. And I then saw a newspaper article in the New York Times, and it talked about these men. And I knew just enough then to know that I should not pay attention to what they said. I didn't really care what their opinion was. I wanted the part of the newspaper article where they go get the opposite opinion. And I wanted the opinion of the commissioner of the IRS. So sure enough, halfway down the article, they go and interview the commissioner. And his line, his answer was... probably the single most important statement ever to change my thinking. He said, if these men have done anything wrong, they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Now, that if just absolutely shattered my illusions, shattered my reality, because in my mind, these guys were already tried and convicted and behind bars. I already had them there, right? If I'd been the judge, the jury, these guys were already behind bars, and the only thing I was going to discuss with them or with anybody was how long they should stay behind bars. And this guy, who's the man who should know, was saying, if. So that's where it all began for me.
Now, income tax, whenever I try to tell people about it, they say, oh, well, you've got to pay your income tax. You know, how else do we get our roads and our hospitals and all of that? And I thought it was the income tax in itself is separate from all the other, 1,000-plus different types of taxes that we pay. And it all just goes to pay debt to foreign banks, which our Prime Minister John Key is lovingly getting us into, considering he's got shares in them.
Yes, well, I can tell you, I mean, we now need to fast forward, 11 years. It's been 11 years since I read that article in the New York Times. We've learned a whole lot more since. Now, I can tell you with certainty that it doesn't matter where that money is going, okay? It's all a smokescreen. The whole monetary ruse is a massive, massive smokescreen. They sit there and they pretend that it's so terribly important that they get X number of dollars out of you this year, you know, to pay for this, to pay for that. Of course, I don't know the situation in America. In New Zealand, I think that half of our road tax, which, of course, we pay at the petrol station, half of that goes to the roads. and the other half goes to fund other government programs. And, yeah, the income tax itself goes to pay basically the interest on the national debt. But again, that's all a smokescreen. It's, I mean, they're talking numbers that are beyond our ability to comprehend, right? You can count the stars in the sky by talking in billions. That's astronomical numbers. And yet Barack Obama will rattle a trillion off as if it's nothing. And
well,
I just yesterday...
You can do that, though, can he? Because they've got a whole bunch of money that they can make up out of thin air.
Yeah, that's another smokescreen. They don't exactly make it up out of thin air. We make it up for them, okay? We actually make it up for them. I had a conversation just about a year ago now with the fellow from the Reserve Bank here in New Zealand, and he shattered some of my illusions. He was a wonderful, friendly gentleman, absolutely honest. I could see it in his face. You talk about the body language of Prime Minister John Key when he's asked these questions. We watched this man's body language, and we knew what he told us was gospel truth. And I can tell you that they do not make up the money out of thin air. There is a mechanism for it that is actually quite sensible, and we're the ones. We create the inflation. We create the ridiculous numbers. Basically, when we go down to our bank and say, oh, yeah, that house that sold for $100,000 last year, because the bank is willing to give me the loan, I'll pay $200,000 this year. Okay, and we sign on the dotted line.
Alan Bollard. Did you get a chance to speak to Alan Bollard?
No, it wasn't Alan Bollard. You know, he's the governor.
Yeah.
So this was, you know, somebody within the bank, you know, whose job was specific to the questions we were asking.
Our Reserve Bank of New Zealand is actually not such a corrupt institution as the Federal Reserve Bank. I mean, our Reserve Bank of New Zealand is actually owned by New Zealand, as far as I understand. But it is toothless because most of our currency, most of our issuance, it doesn't come from it. It doesn't come from
the institution. Well, I'm going to blow the lid on something. You know how to find the truth of any situation? The guys running the show actually are very honest folks, all right? They're very, very truthful. You just have to know where they put the truth. And what they do, because it's worked for them for so long and so well, is they stick the truth in symbols. So, are you familiar with the New Zealand coat of arms?
Oh, yeah.
And... It's got a shield in the center of it, as all coat of arms do. What color is that shield?
It's a red shield, isn't it?
No. Now, the New Zealand coat of arms that you find in the courtrooms and stuff, it's a blue shield. Blue, which signals maritime law, that we're in a maritime jurisdiction.
Okay.
Okay. So now if you walk into the Reserve Bank, this is the New Zealand Reserve Bank, and you just walk through the front doors and look straight ahead, straight down to the end of the corridor, there staring you in the face is a different coat of arms, different to the New Zealand coat of arms. Now what did coat of arms signify?
The house.
Yeah, that's right. And these days we go, obviously if New Zealand's got a coat of arms, that signifies our government. So
the House of Parliament or like the Rothschild have a red shield. That's what Rothschilds mean, so it's the House of Rothschild. Yeah.
So what color do you reckon the shield is on the coat of arms of the Reserve Bank?
No idea.
Red, won't it? It'll be red, the opposite of the...
That's a red shield.
Ah.
That's a red shield. So who owns the New Zealand Reserve Bank of New Zealand is advertised in plain sight for anybody who wants to walk in the doors at number 2, the Terrace Wellington.
Who will they? Who do they say officially owns the Reserve Bank?
Oh yes, they will tell you. There's always an official storyline. Okay,
so they'll say
yes, we're owned by the New Zealand government.
But in terms of transparency, we could force them under the Freedom of Information Act to give up their ownership details.
No. It's not necessary. It's not necessary. You see.
Well, it is necessary for people who don't understand symbology. You see what I mean? Because they're, in their epistemology, the burden of proof wouldn't be in a different colored shield.
Well, all I can say is that when you know what you're looking for, you find it. And then you also know how to move forward. You see, if I needed this in writing in order to take the next step, well, then I'd go do a Freedom of Information Act request. And funny enough, I am actually considering a Freedom of Information Act request to the Reserve Bank. But you could probably guess for the rest of the day and not guess what question I want them to come clean on.
Well, let's not stand on ceremony.
I want the details, not of the national debt. I want the details of my own bond that they are managing for me.
So you want the stock value of your bond, of your dividend on the New York Stock Exchange that they stopped New Zealanders from getting a few years back when they took the number off the bottom of our, the equivalent of your social security number, which you can look up as a trackable stock. Yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who are not aware, when you're born, your birth certificate has a barcode number or a shipping number kind of thing. And if you can search that number on the New York Stock Exchange to find out how much you're worth, all right, because you are property of your government when you're born with a birth certificate. And the birth certificate is basically a receipt.
And it relates to your mass and everything else. That's why even in metric countries, childbirths are still measured in pounds.
Okay. Do you know what the real purpose of that bond is?
To act as an offset to the amount of money that said government can borrow from the central banks as
close.
A collateral on the debt.
Close, yeah. Close. It is indeed an offset. Okay. Now, again, the central government borrows from us. This is what we learned from the Reserve Bank. The central government borrows from us with our consent. It works like this. You want to understand government borrowing? It works like this. It's quite simple. First of all, there's an insignificant amount of money out there in the form of Reserve Bank notes and coins. In New Zealand, it's, at any given time, it's 2 to 3% of our economy. So, you know, if you want to crash the economy, just close the banks and rely on cash alone, and you instantaneously evaporate 97-98% of the entire economy. So the government is not borrowing cash from the Reserve Bank like many people believe. What the government is borrowing is bank credit from the banks. But how does that bank credit come into existence? As I just said, it comes into existence every time you trot into the bank and sign on the dotted line, and they, through a mechanism that is not quite, it's not creating it out of thin air, through a mechanism that involves your birth certificate, they put that credit into circulation. So when you go borrow $200,000 for a house at the bank, that gets offset by a $200,000 ledger book entry against your birth certificate. Okay, so that's what the birth certificate, that's part of how the birth certificate is used. Now there's $200,000 in bank credit sitting around the economy, and the Treasury goes out there. Now these are private people passing around bank credits all over the world. The Treasury goes out there and issues bonds which are purchased by private parties. So people who have got their hands on some of this private credit go and voluntarily again purchase New Zealand government bonds, and now the national debt goes up. So it's a totally voluntary system. It's unbelievably just. is nobody, there's no gun to anybody's head here.
Conveniently, a very special guest coming at us live from New Zealand is Gordon Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on American Freedom Radio and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, and brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. If you'd like to listen to our Kiwi guests, go to our Kiwi Collaborators archive section. We'll be right back after the break with more from Gordon Israel.
About there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Usury is not dead. In fact, it's never been more alive. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. Speaking of collaborators, our Kiwi Collaborator segment today, we are joined by Gordon Israel. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, speaking of a new world order, I'd love it if you could actually define how did the system, as effed up as it is, actually get created? And more to the point, who's responsible for it? if you're able to even answer that question, because I sure as heck can't.
Well, I trace the roots for the roots of it. Certainly the foundations of our modern system. All the key aspects I trace back to Queen Elizabeth I and one of her main advisors, Sir Francis Bacon. And Bacon is well known for his cryptography, Baconian ciphers, and a few other things. But he's actually suspected of being the actual brains behind Shakespeare. And He was known to have a circle of the key intellectuals of his day, and he had an agenda. He was also a Mason, and he had an agenda that he executed amazingly well, although most of the work that we see, other people get credited for. So Shakespeare would be one example. The King James Bible. This is the 400th year anniversary of the King James Bible. That would have been commenced while Bacon was still around under Queen Elizabeth I. And a number of other things, including my personal favorite, the East India Company, which is a corporation formed in around 1602 and still legally, you know, a legally structured company to this day. Even though they will tell you in the history that it was shut down sometime in the 1700s, I believe.
They went through a rebranding process.
Yeah, well, a fellow from India apparently bought the shares a couple of years ago. So obviously there had to be shares worth purchasing. So how is it that company is still in existence? Somebody hung on to the shares all these years.
Yeah.
Anyway. It would take a lot longer than you have on this show to then detail what Sir Francis Bacon laid out, you know, as his plan. But in essence, you had the several different systems of law rolled out. The common law was enshrined in the King James Bible, and then they rolled out admiralty law across the planet, starting first with the East India Company. Most people think of the sun never setting on the British Empire, but what they don't know is that the British Empire was not the British Empire. The British Empire was the East India Company. And if you look at the history, at the time of Queen Elizabeth I, England was a little island out the back of nowhere. Nobody cared about it. Spain was the reigning power, the European superpower. They'd been stealing gold from the Americas for 100 years. Nobody could stop them. And Queen Elizabeth, I suspect with the help of a key advisor, came up with a very simple plan. And the simple plan was that stop trying to do it all yourself, Your Majesty. You're too small, too impotent. You don't have the power. You don't have the wealth. Can't possibly rally the resources. Give your individual subjects the motivation to go out and do what you want. So at the time, with the Spanish bringing back all of these ships laden with gold, the private motivation was a bunch of English buccaneers out there. They're pirates. They're just raiding these Spanish ships as they were able to. And what Queen Elizabeth came up with was the concept of privateering. She legitimized piracy by giving them a commission. Now, if you've ever dealt with a commissioner, you've dealt with somebody with a commission. And she gave commissions to the privateers and told them, now, if you go attack the Spanish ships, because I'm at war with Spain, you see, what you're doing is legal, and you now have my official blessing. And so
it's like
suddenly...
It's like legalizing mercenary activity, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, the most famous privateer of her day was Sir Francis Drake, and you can read all of his history. And the most famous triumph, if you will, of the privateers was against the Spanish Armada. Spain thought, yep, we're going to we're the superpower. We're going to sail around England and take over that little no-count island. And it was not Queen Elizabeth and her wealth and power that stopped them. It was a bunch of privateers with documents signed by her that basically said, fire at will.
Yeah, I mean, now we're getting into it, but I don't think
now,
we've got
you have
enough
to see
time to actually delve right into the blood on the hands of the East India Company. But Francis Bacon certainly was an interesting individual, and as you'd probably know, he's a member of the Hellfire Club, because Masonry wasn't too hardcore enough for him. And but he also is identified with the Baconian method, which is known as the scientific method, and he's
correct.
The father of empiricism, what most people think is empirical logic. And this is what gets me about the scientific establishment of today. Like, I believe in science too, and I believe in the application of science as a tool set to understand the world, not as the meaning of the world.
Yeah.
See, this is the problem. This is just my little rant, on a personal side note here. The problem I see in a lot of people's thinking today is that the scientific method has been compromised, and it's basically rooted in these occultists like Francis Bacon and their own...
Well, what does the word occult
point,
mean?
Case in point, climate cultists.
Exactly.
What's that?
Exactly. Climate cultists and evolutionists too, believe
it or not. Yeah, but what does the word occult mean?
Hidden.
Hidden, that's right. Secret knowledge. And Bacon certainly... had access to some secret knowledge that he let out. If you read the Baconian method, yes, he absolutely changed science. He laid the foundation for the modern scientific method. The man was a genius. He created, as far as I can tell, and I'm no expert on Bacon. I just lift the lid on things and see what I find there. But he created the modern world. We would not have travel by jet aircraft today were it not for Sir Francis Bacon telling people what logical path to follow to discover natural laws. Natural laws such as lift from an airplane's wing. How do you figure that out? His Baconian method laid the foundation for that.
Yeah, so
I don't know whether
Bernoulli—that's Bernoulli's theorem in particular, that one, but there were like minds on similar paths all around the world, and there were kind of philosophical differences between people on the same scientific path as him at the time.
Yeah.
You could say, but then his version was dominant just like Darwin versus Lamarck, for instance.
Yep.
Darwin
yep.
was dominant because he was backed by the eugenicist scum occult freaks who run Britain.
Yeah, but I see I see a big difference between Darwin and Bacon, because I can't fault anything that so far that I've read that Bacon has written. It may not be that he has the entire truth, but certainly he's not promoting. He wasn't promoting falsehood, you know, a skewed view of the world. Your question was about the New World Order and how, you know, that was formed, and he laid all the foundations that we now see coming to fruition today. Without the foundations that he laid, with the blessing of Queen Elizabeth and later on King James, we wouldn't be in the world we're in today.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people get real freaked out by that, but I'm not, because I eat bacon for breakfast.
Yes, I do. I do find his name somewhat humorous, especially since a lot of people think he was Jewish.
A lot of people say it's a fake name, but anyway. There's no doubt that a lot of great things in this world wouldn't have come without sort of their cornerstones, so to speak.
Are you familiar with his treatise called A New Atlantis, or The New Atlantis?
Exactly. So this is the whole point, is Bacon was laying out some certain principles in future vision of the world that he wanted to see, in keeping
yep.
with their idea of the great work. And
yep.
then they just go and say, oh, conspiracy theorists think he was a Mason or a Rosicrucian or a Templar or this, that, and the other.
Yep.
Well, it's no theory. I mean, he openly commenced the Hellfire Club, co-commenced it, in central London. Anyway, without going into Bacon too much, going back to the New Zealand coat of arms, so see there's actually blue and red in a diametric symmetrical pattern on the New Zealand coat of arms, and in one in the bottom left hand corner there is in fact a sheaf of wheat.
Yep.
And what that represents?
Actually, no. I don't know every symbol out there, but I'll tell you what another one of them represents.
The wheat is just like the oil and the wine. The wheat is an intrinsic part of Masonic ritual, and the wheat generally represents the fruits of our labor.
Yeah.
But that's just a low level anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, carry on, sorry.
But the how many ships are on the New Zealand coat of arms?
It's three of them.
Three of them. Now, how many have you ever, you probably have never, but you can look this up, look up the coat of arms of the East India Trading Company. Guess how many ships are on it.
About the East India Trading Company was the flag, you know. It's got the British Union Jack and then the red and white stripes of the U.S. flag. Which
that's right.
Became,
that's exactly that's, right. That's, yep.
You know, and it's like, oh, hold on a second. So what's going on
here? The symbolism, like I say, it's all hidden in the symbolism, you see. So New Zealand is a jurisdiction. It's a sub-jurisdiction of the East India Company. That's what the three ships tell us.
You see red, white, and blue on the Dutch flag, the French flag, the British, obviously the Union Jack, which is a swastika.
Yeah.
The American, New Zealand, Australian. You see red, white, and blue because these aren't U.S. colors. That's nonsense.
These
are Masonic colors. They go from one end of the spectrum to the other, and then white is the combined spectrum of light.
Yeah. I've got a simpler explanation for that, and that is that red is common law, represents blood. White is ecclesiastical law for purity. And blue is maritime law for water.
Yeah, I was just going beyond that and saying why, because the spectrum of light goes from infrared to ultraviolet. Yeah, ultraviolet can be simplified as blue, and infrared can be simplified as red.
Sure.
And so they cover the whole spectrum. That's why the Labour Party represents themselves as red, and the National Party represents themselves as blue, and between the two-party system, they cover the whole spectrum of society in their control. And that's how they do it. And then you combine all the spectrum of light, which they say they ask for more light, and they believe Lucifer is light and everything else. You combine all the light and you get white.
Yep. Yep, yep. But, you see, I look at these symbols and I see the good in them. I think it's just downright nice and honorable of the Rothschilds to tell us in plain English, plain symbols, easily understood symbols, that they own the Reserve Bank. It really warms my heart. I walk in there and I know who I'm dealing with.
Right? Murdering scum. Yeah.
I love
those honest, honorable murdering scum.
Well, look, I just explained to you how the national debt and consequently the inflation and all that comes with it is entirely a product of individual decisions made by private people such as you and me.
Oh, yes. And we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with our very special guest, Gordon Israel, final segment after the break on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Gentlemen to the show that's all about being just a little bit better than scum. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. It's a friggin' miracle that we haven't been assassinated yet. Yet being the operative word. Our very special guest who joins me on that sentiment is Gordon Israel, coming at us live from New Zealand. Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Now, Will, you had a little something to say, because the occultists, meaning the hidden and that kind of thing, society's run in a very underhanded way, isn't it? And the only way that it keeps continuing to function in such an underhanded way is because the truth is kept secret and has been for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Gordon. I mean, that in a lot of ways the public consents to this, whatever's been run on them. But largely they do it not out of knowing, but because the establishment are so good at hiding things in plain view, and because people aren't educated in a certain way in order to respond to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, at the same time as I can see the average individual's to blame, I'm to blame, everyone's to blame, I still blame the elite, because they've set this up knowingly, and they knowingly deceive people.
Yeah. So two things come to mind. One is, if what they're doing is so evil, why do they hide so many clues in plain sight? And that's the first question. And the second one is, there's a fella who hung around, was known to hang around in a certain part of this earth 2,000 years ago, who intentionally spoke everything in riddles. We call them parables. And his disciples asked him, well, why do you teach in parables? And he said, this is not stuff the common man's entitled to know, more or less. I mean, I'm not quoting him verbatim, of course. And yet people go and worship this guy on, Sundays, most every week, of the year, and say he was a really good guy and he wanted the best for the world. So why do you keep his message secret?
I can answer those two. The first one is that the establishment put out code and talk in analogy and use symbology, so that only an elect is a way of initiating people.
Yeah.
You only get the initiates you want, and so only an elect can understand, and then they'll go, oh, well, you can understand us, hey, do you want to join? And they'll say no, and they'll say, okay, we're going to stuff your life up. I'll say, fine. But it's question number two. So question number one is basically secret societies don't want scum joining their groups who don't understand them. Question number two is that when it comes to parables and so on, and why Jesus spoke in riddles, you could say, according to a lot of anyway, according to Paul and John and whoever else, I mean, that was also to not just protect knowledge, but to make sure that only those who truly loved God and understood God in a higher form could become close to that knowledge.
Yep.
It's the same way. So secret societies want initiates that are capable of understanding on their level in the same way that a supposed creator would.
Yeah. Well, I'm in full agreement with you.
They're not actually doing that. That's just controlled, corporate, organized religion bullshit. People like idiots like Benny Hinn and freaks jumping around on stage. They don't understand Jack.
Let's not go there. I'm in full agreement with you on your second answer about why Jesus spoke in parables. Now, your first answer about keeping things speaking in code, you have to be an initiate in order to understand it. I'm not a Mason. Never been even asked to join the Masons. I have over the years had some friends and relatives who were Masons, and one or two in particular saw fit to just fill me in on a few bits and snatches of Masonic history. And
What you're pushing at.
What's that?
They didn't write the Bible, if that's what they told you.
No. They
all make the pyramids.
They told me some very interesting bits of Masonic history that was common knowledge to a Mason, but not common knowledge, certainly not taught in the schools. And anyway, a few years later, I was just absolutely floored when I watched a particular movie and I saw all this same history, just as they had told it to me, put in this movie and ascribed to the Masons. Did you know what movie that is?
National Treasure.
Bingo.
June.
Bingo. National Treasure. Right.
National
Walt Disney.
Nicolas Cage, really?
Nicolas Cage.
National Treasure 2. Wow. Yep. Okay.
Sorry. Okay, now, so the first one, they talk about the Masons in hushed, hallowed tones and talk about them as being the good guys. And they tell you all this history. Well, nobody has to be an initiate to watch National Treasure. If they want to know the basic outline of Masonic history, it's all in there.
Yeah.
Now, that movie is all about searching for a national treasure. You reckon that's an allegory for something?
Yeah.
It's an allegory for a treasure, like the movie says, that we're all entitled to. What is that treasure?
Yeah, no,
it's the bonds. It's the bonds with our birth tied to our birth certificates. Movie end? Where do they actually locate the treasure?
National Treasure 2. They go and dig up.
No, not number two. Number one.
It's underneath a graveyard.
Underneath a graveyard, Trinity Church. Where is that church?
In New York City, on Wall Street.
The corner of Wall Street and Broadway. Mm. Now, just yesterday, as it happens, that's why
we're out of time here, Gordon.
We're out of time. Sorry, mate.
Well, find out the two buildings that are across the street.
All right. Do you have a website at all, Gordon?
I do not, but I'm about to start giving some seminars.
All right. Well, make sure you send that information through to me, and I'll put it up on my website for you there. Thanks so much for coming on, man. It's been pretty inspirationally awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great info. Have you on again, okay?
Okay, brilliant.
All right, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Gordon Israel. It's been exciting. And we'll be back tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, with more of the lighter side of genocide at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. See you tomorrow.